you. Full screen. For our next speaker, we have Dr. Apostol Vasilev. He's the technical director of the CMVP and a research team lead in the Security Testing and Validation and Measurement Group at NIST. He leads research in testing methodologies and standards for cryptographic implementations and works with industry, academia, and government agencies to develop and promote better cybersecurity testing and measurement. Dr. Vasilev holds a PhD in mathematics, and he holds 5 U.S. patents and has authored over 30 scientific papers. Apostol?
Thank you, Ryan. Hello. I'm completely aware that this is the last session of the last talk of the session. It's yet another talk on entropy, so I'll try to not leave you with dizzy heads at the end of the show. So this is a joint presentation with Bobby Staples. Bobby is a colleague of mine at NIST, and he works in the same team, the Security Test and Validation and Measurement Group. So we're trying to research ideas that are related to the validation programs and could possibly benefit some of them. So this is a talk on entropy, and just to start with a perspective on cryptography, we sort of live in glorious times. If you're a cryptographer, cryptography evolves at extremely fast pace, and as it goes, as our devices go small with the IoT environment, our crypto goes small with lightweight crypto or lighter versions of legacy protocols such as tiny DTLS or lightweight DTLS, all of this good stuff. And as our computing technology goes bigger, like quantum computers, our crypto goes bigger with quantum resistance cryptography and all of this stuff. And so this is all good and nice, but the question is, have we solved all known problems that have sort of faced cryptography, conventional cryptography today, as we sort of embark on these new horizons? And just to sort of put a quick note on what we're talking about here. In modern cryptography, all the algorithms are known, and therefore key generation and management and governed essentially the security of the keys, and of course that in turn is dependent on entropy. So that's how essentially entropy enters into the picture, and that's why it is fundamentally important for cryptography. And so really, that's really the big elephant in the room. So where are the keys coming from? And that's the question that everybody is chasing. There's a number of talks related to crypto today, the difficulties that validation programs are having with it. Everybody is looking for an answer to that very question. Where is the keys coming from? And so it's more than just an academic concern, really, and that's essentially some examples I'm going to have to convince you now that this actually has some practical traction or real traction in the world, that these are not just sort of empty concerns that we all have just because we have nothing better to do, right? And so the first example I'm going to take is a recent example where somebody had factored RSA keys from say a government-certified smart card out there in Taiwan. And the issue there was that, there are many issues, but the core issue was that a very weak true random number generator was being used, as indicated here by the sequence of pretty deterministic values that come out of it, right? And the message that I want to make here is that since we all are talking about IoT and the challenges and all of that, the main reason the researchers found for using this design were essentially economic. Nobody wanted to pay money for enough money to get a decent random number generator or better random number generator on that card. And this is only to illustrate that if you are thinking about optimizing one-dimensional problem in one dimension, you may end up with problems of unexpected kind. And so in security, we always struggle between economics and technical issues. And this is simply a point of saying that we're not discounting the economics, but you shouldn't be sort of overestimating the importance of that aspect. And of course, Another good example is the famous or infamous Mining Your Peace and Cues paper, where a group of researchers set out to figure what's going on with actually the security of keys used by network devices out there. And they did a study of about 28 million TLS and 23 million SSH hosts, and they found something disturbing. In fact, that many of them are really having issues with generating good keys, and they sort of announced, or the team found, that about 0.75% of TLS certificate share key. Now, 0.75% is not a big number. However, if you multiply by 28 million, that gets to a sizable number of servers out there. And so that's the point. And then, of course, the issue was not just the TLS certificates, but they revealed RSA private key weaknesses. All the DSA signatures were compromised, all because of insufficient randomness. So then Bobby and I wanted to sort of see for ourselves that this was actually a valid academic result. So we set out to sort of look into the Linux kernel and see what indeed is going on there. And of course, there's sort of expected and unexpected findings on this graph. One is that indeed, it takes time to sort of accumulate entropy in the Linux kernel. We took Linux, let me make it clear, we took Linux because it's available and ready to use and you can play with it. It's not to pick a fight with Linux by any means, so don't misunderstand defining this particular report here. The other thing is that on the Linux system, there's four subsystems in the kernel that contribute to entropy: device, input, interrupt, and disk. And naturally, if you disable some of them in trying to emulate environments where you may have you may not have input devices, or you may have, let's say, a solid state disk that doesn't give you much entropy and all of that, you would expect that if you remove some of these sources, it will take you longer to pass this all important red line, which is the 112 bits minimum required strength by the standard. And that all works out fine. What we found slightly surprising, and actually wasn't surprising, that's the same thing that the researchers from the previous paper found, is that most of the key generation in Linux, the very important keys that are used for everything else, happened in the very early times right after boot. And as you can see, you're well below the red line there at that point. And effectively, that is the open door that the researchers exploited in order to factor the keys that they factored in on the previous slide. And we found some really amusing values that are being requested from users of the DevRandom and DevViewRandom. You get, shortly after boot, you get immediately requests for up to 4,096 bits of entropy going to the server, to the API, when you barely have maybe 30. It's not, again, to pass a judgment. We're just simply trying to make sense of what's going on in the Linux kernel, right? So anyway, that's kind of what we found out. And I'll come to this experiment a little later in my slide. Another point I want to make is that anyone who's tried to estimate randomness should know by now that estimating randomness is actually hard. And if you don't think so, you probably haven't spent enough time on the problem, I would venture to say. And so for a while, a lot of people thought that, well, just take a finite set of statistical tests and do some math with them and see what answer we get, and that's the end of story. But it isn't. And a simple example of that is that if you, let's say, take a well-known irrational number like the number pi and expand the binary sequence and run it through 90B, I'll make a bet with you that you're going to pass the test, right? And we did that. Actually, last year, the year before, we had an intern student, and we asked her to do just that, and she did. And indeed, we passed. Another example is a couple of weeks ago we had a DRPG workshop at NIST, and some researchers came there and gave nice talks. And one in particular I found illuminating, and that's the talk by Victor Fisher, who essentially talked about the challenges in random number generation in hardware devices. And so the approach he advocated was that really in hardware you have four types of sources. Those that are really truly random sources, those that are correlated sources, those that are biased sources, and those that are malleable sources, sources that depend on environmental noises. And the point he was making was that you have to have a really good model differentiating all these different sources, because if you don't, the statistical test will never be able to distinguish any of them and sort out this mutual correlation and malleable noise from the environment. And you're going to get some estimate. You may be happy with the estimate, but the point Victor was making is that in the end, somebody can manipulate your environment and you're going to get nothing out of it. In a sense, they'll break your keys. And so the idea there was that you have to have a very well thought out, sophisticated model, and complement that model with statistical tests, and only then you can argue that you have entropy. But just think about the difficulties that requirement puts on the problem of estimating entropy. We thought that we have difficulties now, but with 90B, the message I took away from the workshop was that 90B is moving in a way, the team that is writing it is moving in the same way to require model to be created for the random source, and only then complemented with the statistical test, which means that you have to have well understood, well reasoned models coming out of the industry describing what these random sources are. You have to have a corresponding set of expertise and knowledge with the laboratories who is going to test it, and then we have to set a whole new level of understanding in the validation program to be able to consume this data and make sure that everything lines up well. So that's a whole new level of complexity, and many of you have heard me talk about sort of streamlining or automating the processes, and we are sort of concerned with the fact that if you, again, are going to rely on even more complicated evidence in the form of test reports or English essays describing what entropy is, we're going to sort of, circle in the same loop of trying to see why we take so long in our validation programs and why we're so confused about entropy and all of that. So we said, all right, if that is the case, then what can be done? Why can't we just convert the problem of estimating entropy to a problem of getting entropy from a known good source? Let's say if you had a way of getting entropy from a known good source, you don't have to ask how much entropy you've got. You know what you've got, right? And so then you can use it. And essentially that's the approach we decided to explore. So before I tell you what our solution is, I want to make sure that we're on the same page here. And first of all, this is not a key generation service. I know that sounds strange when a person working for a U.S. government institution talks about entropy and providing it to you for generating keys. Everybody gets suspicious. But I want to make sure that you understand that this is not a key generation service. We are advocating an architecture where you will be able to generate keys locally in a way that's totally independent from the source, and I'll get to that in a little bit. And the solution here is also not similar to the NIST beacon. Many of you may be familiar with the current random beacon that NIST provides, but that's public randomness. It's used for totally different class of applications, and we're not talking about that. The random beacon maintains very meticulous records of what numbers were generated when. And obviously, that will be exactly the opposite of what we want for cryptographic purposes. So we are not envisioning a server that records any of that data. We were actually saying the server does not remember anything about the data that it records, nor the keys or the requesters that it sent it to. So that's the model we're following with that. And of course, before I go to the next slide, I want to say that we're not envisioning a solution to every problem related to entropy. We're thinking about essentially devices that have network connectivity, but at the same time are constrained in their ability to generate random data locally or to generate it quickly enough to fulfill whatever requirements they have. And so that's an idea for the architecture we have. We have on the right-hand side a server, a web server, that has in the back end a powerful random number generating device, such as quantum source or anything like that. And it has a sort of a REST API such that if you come to it with let's say a public key, it will wrap some amount of data that you request and a number of bytes of that you request. It will wrap that amount of data to you and send it back. But you can say, wait a minute, how do I come to you with a public key if I don't have entropy? So it's sort of a chicken and egg problem, right? How do you solve that issue? And we're saying, well, we're not playing sort of funny games here. We're saying, look, it is much cheaper and easier for you to provision a key at a factory or at an enterprise than to develop good, true, local random number capability. And that's a message that not just ours, but many people have come up to the same conclusion. Late last fall, there was a IoT security workshop at the University of Maryland, and one researcher made a point of saying that when you're looking at the IoT space, she estimated that in some of the smaller devices, you would have to dedicate about 90% of the silicon real estate solely to generating good random numbers. And that leaves you only with 10% of the silicon dedicated to the primary function this device was meant to do. And so it tells you that the economics of this are not there. And when the economics are not there, we know that things are not going to happen. And so so this is a long way of saying again that in many cases, it's actually easier for you to provision a key or either at the factory or at the enterprise that uses a particular device than to implement a good, solid random number generation capability. So if you had a client that somehow had this key, whether it's in the factory or something, or the enterprise provisioned it, then they can use this key in order to access the server, get entropy, and basically start generating random numbers with that. A very brief sketch of the protocol. It's extremely simple. You go to the server with your own public key and a number of requested bytes. The server gives you back the data that you requested, digitally signs it, and timestamps it. Why do you need to timestamp it? Because we need to sort of be able to control. We don't want people to replay stale data, even if it comes from a good server to a client for a variety of reasons. And so there's this timestamping request. In fact, since I'm talking about timestamping, think about there's a good analogy actually between this entropy as a service concept and network time. Right, we're all kind of used to the concept of having network time, and we know that usually in order to get a decent value for what the network time is, you have to hit more than one time server so that you can account for network latency and all of this good stuff. And so we are sort of thinking about the same idea that it's not just the NIST server that is going to do entropy as a service, but we're envisioning an ecosystem of servers that may be hosted on the internet that you can hit at the same time, and I'll explain in a minute why that is necessary, so that you get this amount of entropy and insurance against anyone abusing a particular server that you may depend. So here is essentially the model by which we envision client would use entropy from the server. You obviously have some local entropy, however little it may be, and input from entropy as a service servers, and then you mix them locally before you provide a seed to your DRBG. Okay, and only then use the output from the DRBG for generating local keys. So if you mix this data correctly, you could quickly find out that any of the servers has no visibility into the value of the seed. So you get the benefit of having good entropy and insurance that nobody can look into your local key generation that way. A note about mixing. You know, you have to be a little careful how you mix data from entropy, remote entropy servers, and local entropy. In particular, if you just do XORing and you have buffers of different length, if you're not careful enough, you can let a remote data propagate directly into your seed, which is not a good idea. Instead, you're better off basically concatenating and hashing it so that it gives you a very quick and easy way to mix the data and not allow any of the originating servers a possibility of knowing what your seed is going to be. So based on that, you can sort of think of a key management protocol. Remember, we started out with this sort of factory provisioned or enterprise provisioned key, but you don't want to use it as a static key for too long. So if you had an entropy like that, entropy source like that, you could use the key to access data from the server, mix it, seed your DRBG, get the output from it, and you can use the DRBG to generate a new key and replace the factory provisioned key with that new key, and then keep recycling the key on every time you go to the remote server. And so if you had, let's say, a factory provisioned key, this mechanism allows you to basically sever the relationship with the factory and not depend on somebody then breaking into the factory and finding out what this mechanism allows you to do. So with that mechanism, you can actually sketch a proof that you have for the EES keys. In particular, you can show that you have perfect forward secrecy property, which is a highly desirable property for this sort of key material and the protocols that you may construct on top of that. And so so let me go back to the Linux kernel example. So when we did sort of instrument the Linux kernel with the capability to access the ES server that we have in-house, by the way, we have started the implementation of that, and we have a working prototype, so our hope is that in the next few weeks we can stand up a prototype service, but we'll get to that a little later. So we see that, first of all, we are operating, once you see the Linux kernel with entropy from our EES instance, with operating at a much higher level, and of course we then in the process found that there's this mysterious process in the Linux kernel that consumes entropy at sort of equal intervals, and we're just curious enough to find out what it was, and of course, as you can see, this process doesn't kick in the lower end of the graph when there isn't entropy, but then once you have enough, it starts to kick at regular intervals, and we found out that somehow the Linux process scheduler comes along and every so often takes 128 bits of entropy away from the kernel. It depletes the kernel by that much. And so the question is, I was puzzled really, why do you need to do that? You know, what is so secret about the process scheduling on Linux? I understand that, you know, you got to do fair scheduling and all that, but you don't need to deplete your random source by 128 bits for that. I mean, and they do it every minute or so, you know, so that's kind of excessive, but again, I'm not passing judgment on that. I was just puzzled by what is going on. In any way, so as you can see, if you did that, then you got enough entropy from the get-go, and you can start playing interesting games with it. And in one particular use case that we sort of envision of interest to enterprises maybe is the so-called enterprise key strand attestation. Well, think of it as a large enterprise, and nowadays, at least in the government, many of these network administrators or security officers ask the question, well, how secure are you today, right? And that's a very hard problem to answer. And we're not suggesting that we have the answer to that, but when you have a hard problem, you can think of decomposing it into a set of problems, smaller problems that you can solve, and then you can start arguing. Okay, if that the big question I can answer, maybe I can start thinking about at least the data in transit or data at rest, and if the security of data in transit or data in rest, and if you're thinking about those flows and you can argue that they're secure, then you can say, well, look. The security of those things is dependent on cryptography. Well, once you start analyzing this angle, then you come down to entropy, right? Key strand. And so then, reverse, if you know your key strand, then you can argue about the strength of your crypto, then you can argue about the protection of your data at rest and data in transit. So this gives you at least a partial handle of at least answering a portion of how strong, how secure am I today? Question, right? And so, so what we instrumented as a demo is essentially a configuration where we have, let's say, a key that's provisioned in a TPM of a system, and we use the EES to essentially acquire a certain amount of data and put a floor on what the entropy of that particular system is. And when we do that, we actually put a say an entry into the event log of the system saying, well, at this point I know that on this particular node I can rely on, let's say, 256 bits of strength of keys, which would then allow a system administrator to come in with a protocol like SCAP and determine that your, say, network node is in compliance with, let's say, corporate security policy. And so this gives you a handle of the things that you could do once you have a service like that. Essentially, this tells you that that you can put a number on or essentially an exact value of what the key strength on a particular node is. And based on that, you can start sort of arguing about the security posture of your enterprise. So that's one demo that we have. I apologize. I was thinking that I might be able to do it, but it became difficult with our travel restrictions. We're not supposed to take our working machines here when we travel abroad, and that makes it very, very hard to do. So so we have a demo like that. And so now let's talk about a couple of things about potential attacks that come to mind when you have a service like that. Well, once you have a web service, you have to at least think about the standard attacks that everybody's going to mount on your web service, and you have message replay. I talked about the need to have timestamping and how do you do that. You have to the problem of man in the middle. We're doing public key cryptography here, so the question is, how do you know that you're talking to the right server? And we're saying, well, the only practical way to solve that is essentially by provisioning. So if you're an enterprise and let's say you're planning to develop to either host a service like that within your corporate boundary or you rely on some others, you can provision the keys for each and every services of the servers that you want to use into the client so that they have the public keys of the corresponding server. So when a message comes from a server, they can check the signature and eliminate the possibility of man in the middle in such a simple way. So there's mechanisms to deal with that. We're not suggesting anything different than what people usually do today to mitigate against something like that. But then there's these other class of attacks that are related to EES in specific, right? What about if I have honest but a curious EES instance? And that is an instance that keeps track of what data they gave to whom at what time, right? And then, say, dishonest, the one that gives you bad entropy, but still just a standalone server, does not collude with others. And what, on top of that, what happens if you have colluding EES instances, right? And so these are hard questions. But again, the approach was saying, well, essentially redundancy and reliance on multiple sources is the only solution to the, to this problem. It's, yes, it is possible to corrupt one server. Maybe it is possible to corrupt two or three servers. But if you have servers spanning different geographic locales and things like that, that becomes a very hard problem for anyone to tackle. And so our suggestion here, or idea, is to promote the creation of an EES ecosystem where servers are hosted in various places of the world, much like the network time today is. You know, you have time servers all around, and you never rely on a single one. You always have to get time from several aggregated properly. It's a very similar idea and approach we're taking. And so the next steps, we've shown it a couple of times, various conferences and things like that, just like this one. Our approach is to be open about it. So we're going to obviously host the NIST service, but we're going to publish our code both for the server and the example clients we have and let people play with it. I mean, we're hoping that there are certain use cases that we think that this approach will land a lot of help, and in particular, VM orchestrations in cloud environments is one that comes to mind, especially in multi-tenant environments where you have the same instances of an OS running on the same hardware, that they have issues with entropy, and we think with an architecture like that, that opens up a lot of possibilities for them. There are other cases. People have started to develop other applications of this entropy that relate to, counterfeit or protecting against counterfeiting of integrated circuits in essentially supply chain management and things like that. These are not applications we envisioned, but the thing is, once you announce something like that, people start to come up with ways to use it in a totally unexpected environment. So anyway, that's where we are. We're hoping, as I said, in a couple of weeks, a few weeks from now, to stand up the service, publish the code, and go from there. And that's the end of my talk. Thanks.
If we're using digital signatures to validate where the entropy is coming from, given that that would be a public server, that means there would be probably at least a root, an intermediate CA, and then the certificate here. By the time my device gets that and it needs entropy, that means it's also got to do revocation checking, which is OCSP, CRLs, all of that, all very messy, and definitely would consume quite a bit of space and time.
Well, that's a classic issue with PKI. In some cases, if you're just thinking of not relying on certificates, but just plain simple key pairs, you could just provision the key and avoid the revocation. But I realize that that's a very limited concept that you could use within a particular enterprise. Maybe it doesn't scale across geographical locales. I mean, there's trade-offs there.
Yes, yeah. I would anticipate if there was NIST set up one of these servers, that would be an awesome target for someone to try to get that key so that they could impersonate and start sending their own entropy.
Well, we recognize that you have to digitally sign. Without that, you have no assurances, and so we cannot escape that. But at the same time, yes, we are limited by the constraints of public key cryptography and certificates based on it. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it's a good question. Thank you.
You addressed a dishonest server, a client with a dishonest server, but I didn't see anything about a dishonest client that was attempting to either manipulate or denial of service the server. Were you planning on limits that a client can request?
Yeah, I mean, well, I didn't mention it, but yeah, we're going to have to sort of police that and prevent servers from being obliterated with enormous numbers of requests. Yes.
Did you think of a failover architecture of any type?
We have not thought that far out yet. But I have to say that we are sort of working with the people who have dealt with these issues at NIST. We remember we're hosting some of the NVD servers and things like that that have been subject to attacks like that. So we have developed sort of institutional knowledge about that. So we're going to benefit from that experience as we move along to host some of these services. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
So I know you're talking about the public service here, but the company I work for has a lot of enterprise customers. A lot of them are financial institutions. So it seems to me that companies like Whitewood and Quintessence, who sort of have these quantum number generators, they're going to have quite a good future, because I think having something in the system that would allow you to generate true random numbers would be very valuable for financial institutions. So I think not just for the small IoT and small companies that need public service, I think generally this is quite a good step forward. So excellent stuff.
Well, certainly. I mean, look, we're saying that this is, as I said, this is not a solution to all problems, right? And so there's many other ways to compensate for entropy. And if you have the ability to deploy quantum devices that you can access from within your corporate network, by all means, use them. And that's my message. And if you have good local entropy, whether it's coming from an Intel chip or something like that, by all means, use it. We're just saying that the variety of platforms that you need entropy on is much, much wider than these two examples. And so it turns that we think that there are plenty of cases where you have no access to either of those things. And so that's where this may be helpful.
Any thoughts on when it might be a valid source for FIPS validation, or whether a justification would be required?
I think that is a good question. I cannot venture to give you a specific timeline. However, as I said, our goal is to stand up a service like that, and if it is sort of once we start feeling comfortable about that, and by that I mean not just NIST, but we see some adoption, whether it's in the industry or some other spheres of our society, then we can start to promote it as a legitimate source for validations, and hopefully save on the amount of time that will be necessary to go through FIPS certification. Yeah.
The entropy, it looked like in your diagram, would be returned clear, just digitally signed.
No, it's encrypted with your public key that you came with.
Oh, so the IoT device would have a public-private key pair and would send that
provision at the factory or you could provision it at the enterprise that acquires that device when you deploy it. Yeah.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Frankly speaking, I have a very bad stomach feeling about this, because you are creating a critical infrastructure of some consequence I cannot imagine about.
If I attack these
servers, so that means, let's say in a couple of years, a lot of modules all over the world would use this system. And if I take it down, then IT worldwide virtually would stop. So the availability of this system would be crucial.
Yeah.
And instead of thinking about central things, wouldn't it be better to have the system but decentralized within the organizations, which can have better controls, or at least not all of them would be affected at the same time?
Well,
so the scale scares me a little bit.
It's sort of saying I'm scared by the internet in a way, right? we don't trust it, but on the other hand, we realize that we cannot live our lives without it. And so what I'm suggesting here is not a central service by any means, but it's a very distributed, much like the internet sort of approach, where you have multiple instances of these things, creating, you said, an infrastructure, a public infrastructure, like what you have for network time. Right? You have multiple servers, many places. One goes down, you go to another one. And so that's the idea. We know that there's need for randomness. And we're saying, well, maybe that's one way to go about it. Let's argue, let's find the problem with it, or if it is, if there's fatal flaw, let's forget about it. But until we know that there's a fatal flaw, I know that there is a need that this thing can service. The question is how resilient it can be, and I think if we follow the distributed nature of the internet, that's a good way to go. We're not creating a single point of failure. That's the last thing we want. We want to create a redundant, resilient infrastructure.
Do NIST in parallel do any research on new concepts, how to collect local entropy?
Not necessarily. We're not a technology sort of product related institution, but we do organize workshops from time to time, like the one that we had two weeks ago, and there were many, many interesting talks on that particular topic. There were people talking about sort of optical quantum systems, what you can do with those, and things of that kind. So we follow the progress, we stimulate exchange of ideas and that sort of thing. By the way, the presentations from the DRBG workshop are on the web, full video and slides, so you can really follow them and see what transpired. I already referenced one of the talks that I thought was very interesting about generating entropy locally on a hardware, conventional hardware device. Some of the difficulties that you have to go through that. Check it out. You may find some of them interesting.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Any more questions?
Doesn't look like it. Thank you, Apostle.
Okay. Appreciate it.